Welcome to the Amazon Legends Podcast, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became powerful sellers, also experts specializing in helping sellers, and both former and current Amazon employees who will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here's your host, Nick Urison.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today has been building digital products for the past 20 years. And recently, he decided to make a change and transition to building physical products. So when he's doing that, he's using AI. So he's kind of bringing his digital product development knowledge into building physical products. And he's currently the vice president of product at Juvo Plus. Juvo Plus is in the business of building brands. So you definitely want to hear from this guy because they have 20,000 individual items. So anybody building brands, I don't know too many that have any more than like maybe 100. So this guy has 20,000 products. So we'll hear from that. When he's not working, he loves anything that has an engine in it. So that's motorbike, car, tractor, bulldozer, I guess, right? So with that, everybody, meet my guest, Paul Wilmes. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Good to see you, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So we're going to get to the bulldozers and the bikes and everything. I want to know what kind of things with an engine in it you've driven. In fact, there is a Shark Tank episode that I want to ask you about. But before that, so let's talk about the private label. So you manage over 20,000 listings, and these are all your products. You're not doing online arbitrage. You're building each one. So tell us, what is the secret to be able to do so many different items building your own brand?
I think it's really a methodical focus on building a portfolio, building a broad catalog, and understanding with each new product, how are you going to compete? Where are you going to compete? Obviously, Amazon's a massive marketplace, but we really set out to do this. We wanted to build a really broad catalog that spanned the most popular categories on Amazon using their data, which has gotten a lot better. And now we've got 17 brands across 15 categories. Active number of SKUs, ASINs, is right around 20,000. And this is what we wanted to do. We wanted to use artificial intelligence, machine learning, own the stack top to bottom. We do everything but actually make the product and build a massive portfolio to ultimately build a valuable business that was able to participate in multiple different product categories. So I don't know that there's one single thing or one specific recipe, but we set out to do this and certainly are achieving the scale that we look to do when the company was founded just over 9 years ago.
9 years ago. So you've masterminded the methodology, which really is the same across all the brands, whether it's 10 items, whether it's one item or 10 items or 20,000 items. The methodology is the same, except that you built it in a way that will scale. So when you and I first discussed this, and I was completely blown away when I saw, because I checked, one of the first things I do is I go to the seller account and click on the seller's name. And there I see the feedback rating and seller ratings with negatives, 30 day, 90 day and lifetime. And then I click on the storefront link and I look at the number of items. So this within 15 seconds, I have a pretty good idea about every seller. So that's what I did with you. And then when I clicked on storefront, it said 1 to 20,000 items. I thought, holy God. So this is no BS. So this is, you're doing this, but the methodology is the same. You just scaled it. So tell us, and you meant, when I ask you, what is it that you do really well? And I remember you mentioned that we know how to turn on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
So first, tell us what turning on a dime means. What are things that you're watching mm-hmm. and then looking to change?
You think when you think about the business as a whole, it's being an expert in the dynamics of selling consumer products in the digital ecosystem. And the dynamics is dynamic. Amazon's always changing. They're introducing new features, new data sets, increased fees, everything coupled with supply chain logistics, procurement, taking that big, massive cargo carrier and shifting it to the left, you have to. And ultimately, understanding what that means and how that impacts the portfolio and being able to address that and assess that for such a large portfolio is what we're really good at. So when we look at something like an FBA fee increase, that's going to impact contribution margin. That's SEM costs, freight, labor, tariffs are still out there and still exist. So we want to know how that's going to impact not just the top sellers, but everything down the group. And what adjustments do we need to make? You could absolutely change prices on everything, but it doesn't mean you're going to continue to sell at the selling speed right. that you had before, because that micro market, that keyword marketplace that you compete on, there's tens, hundreds, if not thousands of individual sellers who may or may not be changing prices as well. They may not have had as much impact from the increase in the selling fee. So you might want to say, well, let's just bump everything up by a buck or two because inflation's high and consumers are expecting higher prices, costing us more money to get products to market. It is the absolute wrong approach. And just having that sensibility about the individual product and its own life cycle, its own ecosystem, and the dynamicism of that, not just when you think about it and you build it and you launch it, but you've got to maintain it long term. And that right. takes a lot of human effort. We've been able to build in some AI and some intelligence that helps raise the flags and say, hey, look at me. I need you to talk to me a little bit. Something's happening here. But ultimately, just understanding that it's a dynamic marketplace and paying attention to every single SKU, like it was your bestseller, or it's the one that needs a little bit more attention to kind of bump up the stack.
Mm-hmm. So I want to dissect this because this is so key, because a lot of the times my clients come to me and they say, we want to sell on Amazon, or they are already selling on Amazon. We want you to help us. It's not working. Either they plateaued or it's just spinning wheels. So the first thing I do is I have a template and I plug in their financial data in terms of each SKU, the cost of the SKU, and then all the fees associated with it. From there, I have three buckets. And then those buckets, each one as a percentage of the sale, in this case, the item price, has to be within certain limits. Mm-hmm. And depending on what the number is, it's color-coded. It's either red or yellow or green. Mm-hmm. So I say, look, there are three buckets here and you need to hit green on all of them. Mm-hmm. If you do hit green on all of them, the final one, which is the net profit, that becomes green automatically. Sometimes one or two buckets may turn yellow or red, but then what matters is the final net profit, net SKU profit. If it's mm-hmm. green, then okay. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I do. But this is applied. And of course, the first thing that we see from these new sellers is all the buckets are red. So, and by the way, you can also offer coupon codes, right? For different promotions. They never factored in the coupon code. The minute that they plug in the coupon code, everything turns red. So that's another thing. So these different circumstances. So what I'd like you to share with us is give us your buckets, starting from the top line, which is the price that you're selling it for. Mm-hmm. What are those layers all the way down to the cost of the item, the landed price? So what are you tracking and where would you like them to be in terms of percentage of the sale?
I think the numbers are going to vary as we play within a band that's anywhere from $15 to $25, $35. So we're not going after super high-end, very expensive products. So we want to be within a certain average sale price. But what we're looking for in terms of new product ideation is competitiveness. We want to be able to compete on five different axes: price, features, design, quality, and presentation. We need to introduce a product that can ultimately compete on one or more of those dimensions for us to want to invest in it. Price typically is, it's kind of a race to the bottom commodity play. There's not a lot of longevity there. Design, absolutely. If you have a good and unique design that is very, not necessarily trend forward on Amazon, but something that is has the potential to sell year in and year out. We're not looking at fad products. We're not doing fidget spinners and weighted blankets. We want products that sold 10 years ago and that are going to sell for another 10 years. And with that, really, what's the thesis behind why as a business we should invest in this product? What's that rationale? And it's got to be able to compete. So you don't necessarily need to compete on all dimensions, but if we're targeting a certain set of keywords or a certain target audience, we want to understand one, who that is and who those are, and how are we going to compete? And do we agree that we have a competitive edge that's not currently available in the marketplace?
And what is the ideal competitive edge? It cannot be price, right? Rule that out right off the bat.
It can be, if you can get a combination of both. I think really where we like to play is high design, high quality, competitive price. We don't necessarily need to be the cheapest one on the page, but if we can combine those factors, and what we've been able to do over the last 9 years is bring everything in-house. So it's great, high quality content in terms of photography, videography. We know the presentation is going to be good. The keyword research is going to be good. SEO, SEM plays a big, big role in that. So we've got those boxes kind of checked with most everything we do, but we want that combination because it's just price, margins are going to degrade over time. Everybody starts to play catch up and it's a race to the bottom, like I was saying before. So it's design, I think, has a major component of that. And typically the products that tend to do better in our experience are those that graphic design, illustration, packaging, typography, you know, all those things that kind of play into a certain theme or a certain target audience. And rustic is different than boho. So we want to be able to combine those elements to build a compelling product that we're able to play defense on once it's in market and starts to sell well.
Mm-hmm. So I understand. So price is not necessarily it is better if it's one of the factors. But yeah. You, what I'm hearing from you is actually two things, even though you mentioned it just like one thing. You say design. It's not just the design of the product and the packaging. It's design of the product and the packaging, and also the graphic representation of that design mm-hmm. of the product and the packaging. That two together. So because a lot of people build a product, and then they have these tacky photos that they took with their iPhone, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So you cannot afford to do that when it's your own brand.
That's it. And Amazon says this time and time again, the main image is the difference between follow through and follow up, or I'm going to move down the page. That is number one most important. It's the with your eyes kind of idea. So it's testing different images, and now you can do some A/B testing with Amazon. And lifestyles, I think, are really, really important. You can have the best product in the world, like you say, but if it's not represented well in the media component, then I think you're going to lose that battle. And one of the great things about Amazon and some of the tools they've introduced in the A+ premium content and being able to do hotspots and infographics that are a little bit more interactive. Video obviously has been around for a while. Being able to tell the story of the brand. I think a lot of consumers are looking for legitimacy mm-hmm. far away. If you're the cheapest product on the page and it looks kind of okay, and then you go in and do a little bit more research and the name doesn't sound quite right. There's not a lot of content there. It's just a cheap thing that, the expectations are low, and maybe yes, maybe no. I think really where they're headed and where we're seeing a lot of success is spending more time on brand, as you mentioned, and really promoting what the brand is, the benefits of the brand, who it's targeted towards, and really what's the value of purchasing a product from one of our brands. So I think that's going to play a much, much more important role going forward. And we're seeing a lot of signals already from Amazon on that front.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the individual layers, but I have one question for you. Price point. What is an optimum price point of an item that you usually decide to sell? You mentioned like 35 to 50, but is that right?
It really depends, because where you decide to spend time or what product category you decide to pursue has very different metrics, very different hallmarks. Certain product categories are going to be a little bit lower priced in general, but they may be higher margin. So we do a lot in the kitchen storage and outdoor space. And we have a brand called Talented Kitchen that makes these beautiful pantry labels. It's all about organization and storage. Well, it's just a bunch of sheets of paper and with stickers, and that's very small, very light, and a good amount of margin. You get into bigger, heavier, more textile-based home decor products where the FBA fees are a little bit higher, a little bit heavier, so the costs associated are slightly higher, and the margins go down. So it's not that we're targeting a specific price point. It more so goes back to the competitive dimensions. We've identified some white space. Typically, we operate within this certain band. Do the economics work, and how and why are we going to be competitive to ultimately introduce a product that satisfies market demand and can be a successful product longer term? So I wouldn't say there's one number that we go after, but we've historically been in kind of the band from 15 up to maybe 35 and a little bit higher.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Because a lot of the times you have products that say they may be, say, $30, and then they're heavy, like 2 pounds, 3 pounds. So when Amazon fees recently, as we record this, beginning of November 2022, they've gone up recently. Mm-hmm. So you're going to pay about $5 and something. Mm-hmm. So if it's $30, and you are in that minimum tier of the standard and the smallest, it's like 15% already, right?
Yeah.
Gone. Plus 15% for Amazon, gone. That's 30%. Yeah. So if your cost of goods sold landed is 30%, which is a pretty good number, now it's 60%, right? Mm-hmm. Already 60% gone. All you are left with is 20%, out of which you have to pay the advertising and everything else. Mm-hmm. So it's still a good number, but that's a good example of how quickly you get to spend the margins, so to speak.
Yeah.
So share with us some of the latest, because I heard you mention any change with FBA fee, for example. We look at how it's going to impact the duty, the taxes, and all the layers down the line. So give us those line items. What are the things that people should be looking at? And what is a good number for you as their share?
The variable cost. So if you think of, like you're saying, simple profit, which is basically costs, estimated revenue minus cost, but there's also that component of variable costs, and costs can change depending on how much marketing you spend, the labor associated with servicing the product. If you have owned and operated warehouses, that's different than maybe cross-docking directly into Amazon FBA, the freight. So just the cost to ship, we've seen it come down obviously quite a bit back to pre-pandemic and historical lows. So what's that cost per unit per CBM? And then the good old 25% penalty, the China tariff that comes off the unit cost. When you factor all those in, I would say really what's comfortable for you. Some companies can operate at very thin margins and high scale. Others want higher margins, maybe lower scale. A lot of it's going to come down to the type of seller I think that you are and what you're looking to ultimately gain. Is it top line revenue? Is it EBITDA margin? Are you just trying to grow the business to be a potential acquisition target? Is it something where it's a lifestyle business and you're totally comfortable doing 20% all in, and you've got a nice steady flow that you can live and survive on. So there, for us, it's not necessarily a specific number or hard and fast rule. We're looking to just really introduce more successful products that we can continue to service and sell, and ultimately have a long-term viable product that'll be in market. Like we say, was in for 10 years and now we've got another 10 years. So I think everybody's a little bit different in that case.
Okay. So what I'm hearing from you is, first of all, picking the right category and the right kind of item at the right price point. Those are key. And what I'm detecting is utility type products, consumable type products are much better to sell instead of selling it once and then you never see them again for maybe a year if you're lucky. Instead, consumable is a better way to go. Would that be right?
I think certainly we've got small business products that we love, the subscribe and save, and Amazon's been pushing a lot more their Amazon small business. That's government, it's small SMBs, where you can sign in as a small business owner and get a certain amount of discount. Absolutely. I mean, those are the kind of set your watch to it sort of products that, you know, you're going to have disposable napkins that you're going to need for your food truck somewhere in the Midwest, and there's not a local Smart and Final or a place you can go get it quite easily enough. So you go to Amazon, love those kind of products. Because we've got such a wide berth in terms of the methodology working across all these different product types and categories and channels, we certainly like those. We also love party supplies and stationery and arts and crafts and bed, bath and decor and kitchen products. We're just hunting for opportunities in all the channels that we think make sense. But I do like those personally. I like those a lot. So that's nice.
So as far as the numbers, before we beat the subject to death, just want to get another take on something. So these layers that you're watching, each expense, so what I'm hearing from you is really you want to create your list of line items in terms of your variable costs, mm-hmm. and then track their contribution, mm-hmm. you know, as a percentage of the sale, mm-hmm. at all times, because mm-hmm. a fluctuation in one of those layers mm-hmm. may impact the overall operation in a significant way. So you want to be able to identify what that is and then isolate it. So what are you watching collectively, like over an entire brand? Is it the same numbers as a composite number for the entire product line, or do you watch other things?
It is, ultimately, we want to understand sales volume, sales speed, profitability per product. So if we introduce a product to market and it sells 30 units a day and we need to reorder quickly and make sure we're not out of stock for any longer than we have to be, that's the sales side. So it's sales volume and discoverability and ultimately purchase and sell through. But with that comes how much profit was generated, how much true profit, which is that contribution margin that we were talking about with the variable costs. And if that number feels like it's something that's sustainable and it's something that's acceptable to us, then we'll continue to do so. I think the really big challenge, and it's not a small, big, everybody in between, it's working capital availability. So just understanding that number and what you're comfortable with and how it impacts cash flow. Some companies may be absolutely over the moon with 10, 15% true margin, but you put a dollar in and it's going to take you 6 months to get it back out. So having that view of the long-term impact of the decisions you make today, taking that much longer to translate into actual revenue, which then the marketplace dynamics are probably going to be a little bit different and more likely than not, Amazon's going to increase fees. And we've just all been through the craziness of the last 2.5 years with supply chain and logistics costs. Certainly you can't forecast what's going to happen in 6 months, but just having that perception or that view of true profit and what that means in terms of cash availability over the long term, if your goal is to reorder and replenish and ultimately put that same product or new products in market, you got to think about working capital, I think, is a big, big one.
Okay. I'm so glad you put this on the table, because this happens to be one of my most favorite subjects, And a lot of Amazon sellers, frankly, a lot of business owners don't even understand it because it's a very complex thing. So we're going to dissect this again because there's several things that you mentioned. First of all, collectively and also at SKU level, because collectively doesn't mean anything unless, you know, it's made up of a bunch of things coming together. So you track collectively, but also you want to be able to drill down at SKU level. I heard you mention you track sales volume. That means how many pieces it's selling per day, per week, per month, right? That's one thing that you are saying. And then I heard you mention sales speed. What do you mean by sales speed?
So we know, and I think this is probably fairly common across the group, in-stock is extremely important to Amazon. So if you're selling, let's say you introduce a certain number of units into market, you've shipped it into FBA and it sells out in 3 days, you're out of stock. So your goal is to get more back in as quickly as possible. That inventory may be overseas, it may be in your local warehouse, but you know it's out of stock and not available for sale. So what we want to understand and try and get a good estimate of is how well the product is selling and when do we need to send more inventory into Amazon? When do we need to reorder the product and try and keep that in stock as high as possible so that it's not off the shelf and not available for sale. So that's one of the metrics we look at is just how well is the product selling and when's it going to go out of stock? And with the inventory we have or we need to order, what should be the best next step to ensure that it's not out of stock for any longer than it needs to be?
So, okay. So what I'm hearing is your number of pieces in stock ensures the longevity of the sales. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. So that's a metric that tells you to reorder or you're good for now until whenever. So that obviously, by watching that, you make sure that you are always in stock. So that gives you the longevity of sales. So at least continuity, it doesn't get interrupted. Sales volume, on the other hand, it tells you this is a good SKU. You want to stay on top of it, maximize the sales, right?
Absolutely.
So what is a good number for sales volume for you to say this is a good SKU?
That's a tough question. With as big of a portfolio as we have, each one of these products is a little bit different. And we have some that generate millions in revenue per year and others that are early comers that may do a couple thousand and some that just don't get off the ground at all. So yeah. I think the approach is similar to the product development methodology of just understanding where there's product market fit and where's that white space that we talk about. With inventory and sales volume, reorder and replenish, ultimately you want to keep enough in stock at Amazon and if you do FBA in their warehouses to satisfy demand, but not necessarily all of it because there are storage costs to store in their warehouse. That does eat into your margin. So there isn't a particular number for each individual product. Each one has its own life cycle, its own treatment in terms of how well it's performing, not necessarily against another one of our products, but really, is it selling how well? And do we have enough to satisfy demand? And if not, then we need to go reorder or get some from existing inventory as quickly as we can. So I think everybody's going to be a little bit different depending on the product and how well it sells and what their situation is in terms of inventory availability and how quickly they can reorder it and get into market. But for us, it's really down to the individual SKU and how well it's doing on its own.
Yeah. So I guess it could also be a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, if you run out of inventory, and obviously the product is not going to sell any, so therefore your sales volume will look low, and you're going to say, oh, this product is not selling. Well, you haven't had enough of it in stock. You kept running out of stock. So what I detect is this, provided that you have enough inventory to maintain continuity of sales, what you need to track is, in grand scheme of things, how does each product compare in sales volume against the top selling item maybe in your portfolio. And so therefore, maybe have some kind of a perspective in the performance of that individual SKU. Do you do that?
I think this goes back to the working capital availability. Is if there's a limited amount of working capital, you've got a choice. Do I want to keep my top seller in market? Maybe it's priced a little bit higher. It generates more net income. Do I want to give a little bit more to the up and coming product that has just gotten off to a very promising start? Yeah. All of that to me, and I think in general, is what's the cash availability? What's the working capital availability? And how are you going to allocate the money that you have or the budget that you have to service existing inventory or focus on new products and introducing new SKUs to the market? So that one, again, it's, you know, I know it's not a very, very direct answer. Yes, go here, spend this amount of money and do that. But it is a really, really dynamic marketplace, and one that as you are in it for long and you've been in this forever, it's always changing, and it's a choice. Everything, every product you decide to do, every moment, hour you spend on developing something new or servicing an existing product, how much you spend on content and marketing, it's a choice in really how you spend your time and resource. So I haven't seen yet a hard and fast, let's only focus on X, because there's always going to be the flip side of that and an opportunity cost of not focusing on the other.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, you're right. So first of all, there's a few things going on all the time in terms of how things change dynamically. One is there's brand new stuff coming out of the blue and then changing things, like pandemic event changed so many things in how people live their lives and do their work. And then also there is the evolution of what we use every day. And today, actually, I came across an ad, and suddenly I thought, you know, this is so true. And the ad said, are you still using conventional landlines in your phone system? And then, you know, I started thinking, you know, nobody uses landlines anymore. It's either cell phones or voice over IP, right? And yeah, it's a soft phone. It's no longer, you don't have phones anymore, right?
No copper lines, no nothing. I saw a similar thing where someone had two cell phones and they referred to one as their landline and one as their cell phone.
Really? Well, I mean, so, okay. What you mentioned is the perfect segue to what I wanted to nail down with you. Working capital availability. So how do you calculate the working capital availability?
In terms of, I'm a new seller, small seller, just looking to get started. I'm an existing medium-sized seller that's trying to expand or grow or larger scale. It's kind of I think depends on where you are in your life cycle and in the ecosystem. Been a lot of fundraising happening in the space. I think there's certainly a number of different ways to secure working capital. Some are self-funded, some just start with an idea and are great at social media and promoting on Instagram and that sort of thing. And that kind of helps build up the following and the discoverability. It's a very good question that I don't know that there's a one size fits all answer. I think ours.
So I have one for you.
All right.
So this is what I always tell people, and this is what most sellers don't understand. So anybody listening, pay attention to this. So let's assume, forget all the complex metrics and margins and everything else. So let's say that you generated $10,000 in sales in a week, in a month, make it a month. And let's say that you're doing a pretty healthy margin. So that means that let's say 25% after all the costs, product, Amazon commission, FBA fee, storage, you name it, advertising, take it all away from your $10,000, you're left with 25% net margin. That gives you $2,500. You sold $10,000. 25% gives you $2,500. That's in your pocket, right? Goes straight into your pocket. That's your liquidity. You can say, you know what, I'm going to take half of that, put the rest back into business. That's working capital. Okay. Now, this is where things get complicated. Now, let's assume that in that 75% you spent out of the sale, 30% was buying the product. That's $3,000. Now, in order to have $3,000 worth of inventory to make that $10,000 sale every month, well, you have to stock up, right? What's the minimum amount of time that you need to carry in stock? At the very least, what I know from, you know, manufacturing in China, transportation, is 3 months' worth. $3,000 times three, $9,000. How much did you generate in net profit? $2,500.
Yeah.
What is your working capital available before you pay anybody a dime? Your entire profit is not even enough to carry what you have to hold at any point in time. That's $9,000 versus $2,500. It's going to take you 4 months just to finance 1 month worth of sales, worth of inventory. So therefore, your working capital requirement is how much inventory you need to keep in stock minus how much liquidity you are generating. That's the working capital requirement. And that's the amount you need to go raise, because you're not going to have enough money. This is the classic case where people say, well, I don't understand. We've got pretty good margins. Our sales are growing, and we never have any money. Because you're not tracking your inventory value. And where things get complicated is people don't even track the value of the inventory they have at Amazon, in their home office, how many POs they have open. That's all your supply pipeline. And you need to know the financial value of it. And people don't track it because it's a systems question and they don't have the systems in place, nor they care about it. Share with us, but first of all, I'd love to hear your take on this. And second, how do you deal with it?
I think you absolutely nailed it. That time horizon of dollar in to the moment it can actually generate revenue for you. 3 months in your example, we've seen it 5-6 pandemic, you extend that out beyond that scope. That's the challenge in working in physical consumer goods, is there's none of that instant gratification like we had in the digital marketing space, where you bring a consumer in, they click on an ad or they buy something and activate a coupon and you get paid the next day. So there is this gap. We've been fortunate that we have founders who come from that space and they were able to fund the company and provide working capital so we could extend beyond that time horizon. Survive during that time horizon and make investments in products that worked well and ultimately paid back over time. It can get really scary really quickly if you've got that $10,000 in sales and you think, I've got a hit on my hand, I need to invest everything I've got into this product. And it does take you 3 to 6 months to get that back because it gets really expensive really, really quickly. But I think the calculation is right on. How you bring that working capital in, I think that's everybody's kind of big question. And you know, if you have a model that works, so you have products that work, and I think you saw this a lot in the aggregator space where it was a small number of SKUs that performed extremely well. Revenue per SKU was off the charts. Some of that may have been lack of working capital and saying, I can only afford a certain number of SKUs and I'm going to just do everything I can and promote on social media and ultimately do the tricks of the trade to get that promotion and discoverability across. But rarely did I see anybody that had more than 60, maybe 100, 150 SKUs in their portfolio overall. And that is a testament to them to be able to do that much and have an exit like that with such a small amount. I think some of that does come from lack of working capital and being able to broaden that portfolio and just making the best of what you got. So that's going to continue to be a challenge, I think, in the Amazon ecosystem. And one thing that was really interesting from the Accelerate conference a month or so ago Amazon mentioned a stat, and I've heard 2 million sellers. I've seen some of their 6 million sellers. 70,000 of those sellers generate $100,000 or more on Amazon out of the millions of sellers that participate in their marketplace. That to me is a very, very small number. And for them to service such a broad base of third-party sellers and all the logistics, everything involved in just doing what they do, managing the inventory and ultimately servicing the consumer, that's a lot of heavy lifting. That number is really small compared to the number that participate. So I think for them, having broader portfolios, more successful products, ultimately generating more revenue per search each time somebody does a search on their page and they've got higher conversion is very much in their best interest. And we're seeing a lot of that now with the data that they're offering to third-party sellers and ultimately helping them identify new opportunities. And now it's Amazon warehouse and distribution if you don't want to own your own warehouse and do it that way. So I think there's a sense that there's more to be done in terms of optimization on certainly the marketplace and the catalog and portfolio on the seller side. From if I was new to this space, it's a lot easier, I think, now to jump in. However, all the hallmarks, everything that's true for companies like ours is the same for someone that says, I'm going to go build Bluetooth mouse adapters. It doesn't change it across the board. So I think that's going to continue to be a challenge, but at least now it's easier to get in and try your wares. And you don't have to be good at all of it. You don't have to be great at supply chain. You don't have to be great at working capital. It's a good skill set to have. If you're great at design, if you're great at marketing and those kind of fit, product market fit and marketing go hand in hand to a certain degree, I don't think you need to be great at all four legs of the stool necessarily. It's how are you going to compete? What is your core skill set and your expertise, knowing that very likely you're not going to be great at everything, but you still may have an opportunity to do well on Amazon, given what they've given us in terms of tools and ability to just get at their audience.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's true. It's you have to win SKU by SKU. Every SKU has to be able to stand on its own feet in terms of its what the product is, its price point, its features and design and everything else, and your approach to promoting it, what keywords and how you're differentiating its content. It's a SKU by SKU battle. And at the same time, you can win every one of these battles, but lose the war if you don't have an infrastructure to track what's going on, because the immediate impact becomes strangulating the company for cash flow. Mm-hmm. And if money runs out, that's the end of the road. Mm-hmm. So you want to be able to track, what am I generating in terms of top line, in terms of what you call true profit? That means after everything. Mm-hmm. And then how does that compare to the amount of inventory I'm carrying at all times? Mm-hmm. That's going to give you exactly how much cash you need to sustain this operation. And in order to track this, you need an infrastructure. Mm-hmm. That means inventory management, real-time going counting stock on the shelf at the end of the month. That's not inventory management. That's just dog and pony show. It makes you feel good that you're doing something, but it doesn't give you anything. So you need to have this infrastructure is going to do. You mentioned something that's the perfect segue to what I want to get out of you, because this is so key: conversion. So we talked about the financial aspect, the working capital and all that. So now flip to the other side of what are some performance metrics that you are tracking on individual listings? What makes some of those activities that, you know, you drive keywords, impressions, click-throughs, and conversions. So share with us some of those. What are the numbers that you're watching, and what should they look like?
I think you'd want to differentiate between sponsored products, the SEM component, and being displayed in those prominent ad spots, conversion on that spend versus organic. And organic is all about visibility. And we know they'll register an impression when you're shown on the page. You might be slot one, you might be slot 16, but that's still an impression. So we're when we're looking at that data and trying to understand those metrics, I think on the SEM side, the sponsored product, sponsored brands, a conversion rate that's certainly better than a typical banner ad that's north of 1-2% feels pretty compelling. We've seen some that are much, much higher, others that are quite a bit lower. Organic really is a challenge because we don't know yet where we were on the page when that impression was registered. So in some cases, if you have a really unique product that fits a certain market and you've got a fantastic reviews priced well, and you're above the fold page one, let's say, you know, top three spots, conversion might be 25%. And that would be great. And obviously you want more, but that may be a bit of an outlier compared to products that are in a much, much more competitive market where you're shown below the ad modules, below the fold, still on page one, but way, way down low, where consumers typically may have already made the purchase decision and they found it in the top spots and said, your product's great, but it hasn't quite filtered up yet. So I think just thinking about the difference between buying sponsored products, buying SEM in ads, and knowing that that's going to be displayed prominently versus how you're ranking in organic and modulating the thinking around, I'd expect conversion on ads to be a little bit lower because the impression volume is quite high. And especially if you're doing automatic targeting and maybe your keywords, not necessarily exact match, but doing broad match and just kind of harvesting keywords, that sort of thing. Organic can be much, much higher if you've earned your way up to that spot and you've got good ratings, good reviews, compelling product, good pricing. But there is certainly a difference between conversion on sponsored and on SEM versus organic. And I think a lot of that has to do with, in the organic side, where you are on the page. And that's from the wish list standpoint, I'd love to be able to know when you register the conversion, where were we? And how did that change over time? Because that, to me, has a massive impact on discoverability and visibility and ultimately driving conversion.
So to clarify, by conversion, you mean click-through rate, right? So how many people clicking on the actual product, that product page or product picture or the title, and to go to your product page. By conversion, that's what you mean, right?
That's from the search page. So the consumer does a search, sees the search results, clicks into our product detail page. From there, obviously, we're tracking metrics on cart, on sale, on cart abandonment. And you know, now there's several more modules you may also like. And would you consider and add this one as well? So it's not 100% win rate, and certainly our conversion rate on the product detail page. But initially, we know they're going to get to us through search. By and large, exactly. They're going to search something.
So this is a very good segue to what I always call the success on Amazon comes down to two magic bullets. It's obviously loaded, you know, definition, but nevertheless, this is how it is. First magic bullet is CTR, click-through rate. On your search results. So people come and people buy because they come to Amazon, they put in their search term, and up comes the search results. Search results have sponsored products in them. They have the organic, of course, 20 per page. Nevertheless, you're going to appear, whether it's paid or organic or both. Sometimes you appear side by side. So they're going to click on it. That's the click-through rate, first magic bullet. How do you increase your click-through rate on the search results? The more click-through rate, the higher the click-through rate, the more people on the product page. The more product people on the product page, the more potentially orders. But that's the first thing. So you can improve the conversion, the click-through rate on the search results, depending on, is it paid? What you know, as you mentioned, sponsored. It's different. Versus organic. Organic is likely to be higher because it's natural. People understand sponsored is paid for. It may be a new one, so they may ignore it. However, what I'm also hearing is the video ads, sponsored brand video ads, the click-through rates are pretty high. So there's different ways to advertise. Nevertheless, that's the first magic bullet. Now comes the second magic bullet. And that's the true conversion rate. That means out of the people who landed on your product page, now you're pitching, right? So your pictures, your bullets, your A-plus content, it's pitching the product. Your reviews there, buy, 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 buy. That's what you're telling the person. And then out of the 100 people who landed on that page, on their product page, how many of them end up buying? Mm-hmm. That's the true conversion rate. So increase the click-through rate, increase the conversion rate, you'll be laughing all the way to the bank.
That's it. Generate more sales.
Yeah. So what I want to, I already heard you mention on sponsored ads, it may be 1% to 3% click-through. Mm-hmm. But on the organics, it may be higher based on your reviews and everything else. So now let's move on to the second magic bullet. What are your expectations? What is a good conversion rate? Do you monitor that?
We do. Not necessarily my team in my group on the product development, the new products and ideating new, but certainly we've got marketing and analytics team that wants to understand that flow from click-through on SERP to the PDF, the product detail page in ultimate conversion in sale. From there, though, you really get the metrics of sales, revenue, margin. You may look to optimize click-through rate, which gets you to more views on the detail page. That number may be higher, maybe lower. Ultimately, we're looking to generate sales and get that. And if we've had a steady state and it's gone down, that's something we want to understand. If it's something that's doing exceptionally well, we'd like to understand that as well. So it's much more so about the unit economics of the individual product itself, as opposed to trying to capture metrics or say everybody's doing 15% on the product detail page when it's a private label buyer and there's no one in the buy box. We should be doing that too. We want to have a successful product. And it really, that is generating sales and being able to reorder and ultimately having that product in market for an extended period of time. So I wouldn't necessarily get as caught up in trying to hit a target metric. More so, you know, you've got to start somewhere. And to me, on that search page, the image is the most important. Clear, right. Concise titles, and you get a little bit of a description, not trying to stuff a whole bunch of keywords in there. Just tell us what it is. And testing that, we can do some variation testing now with Amazon, obviously, on that side. But that's the first step. Good main image, because that's the only thing they're going to see on the search page. Once they get to the detail page, then you've got the carousel, you've got the ability to do the A+, rich media, video. It's about legitimacy to me. Are the bullets clear and concise? Are they written by someone who understands the vernacular and how we're talking and just talks like you and I, and not trying to just stuff a whole bunch of keywords, hoping that the bot picks up and ranks them higher in organic? And I think consumers, once they get to that page, they want to feel like this is a legitimate brand. It's a legitimate company. When it arrives, I'm going to have a good unboxing experience and ultimately have a good experience with this product. And it's worth the money. There's a million different ways you can test kind of one to the next, but the most important, start with the main image, clear, concise titles. And I think this is probably very common when people talk about this in the industry. Once you get to that detail page, who is this brand? What are they about? I want to click on the store like you did. Do they have one rating or do they have 100,000 ratings? How long have they been in business? Can I go to Google or search engine and find this brand? Do they have their own website? I think there's that sense of, I know there's millions of sellers on Amazon and looks okay, but is this going to be a product that's worth me purchasing? And is there some legitimacy behind it? I think is kind of the net.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things contribute to being able to convert. So I always tell my clients, you know, you need to have at least the awareness of what your performance looks like. Yeah. And it's like, you know, my favorite example is when you get in your car and then you're going to go from A to B, which is 300 miles. And you know that once you get on the expressway, you can do 55, 60 miles an hour. It's going to take you about 5-6 hours. But it's not that you get in your car and you look at your speed once, and then you look at it somewhere in the middle, and then at the end, you're always watching how fast you're going. If it's too much traffic, built up area, you're watching your speed. Just like that, you have to watch your performance and then have a reference point. And conversion rate is such a valuable piece of metric that will tell you exactly if you keep bringing the same amount of visitors to your product page, but you improve your conversion 5%, your top line and your bottom line will go through the roof. So that's why I say get an understanding of what it is that you are achieving. Is it 10%, 12%, 15%? Like industry average, if you Google it, will come up 12%. But it's false because it's different on electronics versus clothing versus home. So then what is that for your category? Then have that understanding. And then how do you rank against? So things like that, I always tell people. It's fascinating how these little pieces of numbers, you know, you put together, it gives you a whole business. And if you don't know them, you lose the business, right?
You don't know what you don't know until it's too late. And you think, I probably should have paid attention to that a little bit sooner.
Yeah. You know, the worst ones, this is going way back to the Second Gulf War. It's the famous press conference, you know. You know, there is the known knowns. You know, you know what to do and you know how to do it. There is the known unknowns that you know that you're going to have to deal with. For example, PPC and optimizing the conversion or whatever. But you just don't know how to do it. Just you know that you're going to have to. So that those things you can deal with it. But then there is the unknown unknowns, the things that are going to hit you in the face. Right? So especially in Amazon universe, these things are coming all the time. There's something new and then they change the rule. Like, for example, bullets. It was allowed to have capital letters as the beginning. Now they don't want it. And they can't even suppress a listing depending on new ones. They definitely are. So. These unknown unknowns that will come hit you in the face, that because you don't know them, you don't know what to do. Yes. So you have to be prepared.
There will be more changes and more uncertainty in the future. They're going to change now in perpetuity. That's a known unknown. It's always going to be something that you've got to tune into.
So it's the constant. The only constant is the change.
That's it.
In the Amazon universe. So this was great, Paul. So tell us a little bit about yourself. I want to take you way back to your beginning. So where did you grow up? Where did you go to school?
I grew up in the Bay Area in Northern California, a small town called Los Gatos, just south of San Francisco. Small town, 30,000, very focused on the community and football team in one high school, and just had a phenomenal upbringing, great experience growing up there. And my dad was a motorcycle racer in his early 20s, so he got me into motorcycle racing when I was a kid and wrenching on cars and working on the house. And I think I got my builder side certainly from him, and I've just been in and around cars and boats and motorcycles and jet skis, and not tractors as much, maybe that's in the retirement years, but always been fascinated with building. And I think that's one of the really amazing things about this industry and this business is we get to build things, physical products that people take into their home. They enjoy, they take pictures of it, they post it online, they write reviews, some good, some bad.
They love that. They become fans, right?
That's it. I love that aspect about what we do. It's just, you get to build, and we do it at a pretty sizable clip, and it's a lot of moving parts. And I probably had a little bit more, you know, dark hair on my beard before this whole thing happened. But I love that about this industry is ultimately, you know, if you're walking around your house just trying to figure out stuff to do and go, I'm gonna do a toaster, that's one thing. But if you're understanding the need and the want in the marketplace and where there's opportunity, and get to build that and satisfy that, it's immensely gratifying. And I think that kind of happened for me very early on in my childhood, just being able to see the outcome of you know, tearing down an engine and fixing the carburetor and kind of, oh, there's no spark in the spark plug. Okay, well, maybe it's fouls. All right, let's be, you know, that was things I got to do when I was a kid. And it's, you're just fixing all the time. And there's always something broken and always some fire somewhere. And I think that's been a lot of my childhood that's led really to this point in my career.
So do you have any brothers, sisters?
I have three older brothers. So
were they the same? Did they grow up the same way or not?
Little bit different. So mixed family, and your father was married a few times. I'm my mother's only child, but I've got two older stepbrothers and a half brother. And I think with my upbringing, with my dad, a lot, it was, he and I shared a lot of that sentimentality around just loving old cars and hot rods. And yeah, he'd get me up at 7 o'clock on a Saturday to go mow the lawn and work on the house and repaint the fence. And that was, I think he and I shared a lot of that and that builder aspect of it. So it wasn't really through and through, to the whole family, but certainly I had that, that experience.
I wonder, between the three of you, why you became the one who had that kind of interest. Maybe it was in your blood.
The idea has got to be the nature versus nurture kind of thing. I don't know. I just always love working on stuff and working on cars. And I think he probably a lot to do with him being growing up as a baby boomer and just having an affinity towards the classics, the 50s and 60s hot rods. And he had a hot rod and we built, you know, a classic Mustang was my first car in high school, a 69 Mach 1, and something that he and I restored and spent a year and a half working on together. So I think it's just...
It must be fun just to work on the stuff, you know, getting your hands dirty with your dad by your side. That must be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. He's the guy that can just fix anything. And I've always really looked up to him and respected him for that and tried to emulate that in a lot of ways. And now I get to fix the iPhone and all the technology stuff. And he helps me fix the analog stuff. So it works out.
I tell you what, you're fixing the entire Amazon operation, 20,000 items. Look where it brought you. Don't discount yourself down to fixing iPhones. No, this is a big deal. I'm sure, you know, there are others listening to this who had similar experience. So I mean, look where you are. So this is the result. So this was great. And your dad definitely did a great job, you know, giving you that drive. So tell us, Paul, how can people reach out? Give us your contact information.
So LinkedIn, probably the easiest way. My first name is Paul, last name Willmes. That's probably the best and most efficient way to get to me is through LinkedIn, and happy to sit down with anybody, answer more questions, and you know, certainly appreciate the opportunity to do this. And I think what you're doing is absolutely fantastic. And that's some great, great information that comes in these conversations, and happy you did this and that I got to sit with you for a little bit.
Oh, listen, you are the guy doing the work. 20,000 items. I still cannot imagine 20,000. So I am just trying to bring some light to what you're doing and recognize the work you're doing. But you are the one doing it. So this was great, Paul. Thank you very much.
Absolutely, Nick. Thank you for having me.
And this brings us to the end of another episode. And I'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure and subscribe, rate, and review our show. And be sure and share an episode with a friend. And thank you so much for being with us today. We'll see you next week here on Amazon Legends.